drive it right into the water? Actually, we have a trailer, Mr. Tomke said, so what we do is back it into the lake.
Oh, a trailer. What kind is it?
Well, it's a boat trailer, Mr. Tomke said.
Right, but is it wooden or... You know, I guess what I'm asking is, what style trailer do you have?
Behind my mother's words were two messages. The first and most obvious was, yes, I am talking about boat trailers, but also I am dying. The second, meant only for my sisters and me, was, if you do not immediately step forward with that candy, you will never again experience freedom, happiness, or the possibility of my warm embrace. I knew that it was just a matter of time before she came into my room and started collecting the candy herself, grabbing indiscriminately with no regard to my rating system. Had I been thinking straight, I would have hidden the most valuable items in my dresser drawer, but instead, panicked by the thought of her hand on my doorknob, I tore off the wrappers and began cramming the candy bars into my mouth, desperately, like someone in a contest. Most were miniature, which made them easier to accommodate, but still there was only so much room and it was hard to chew and fit more in at the same time. The headache began immediately, and I chalked it up to tension. My mother told the Tomke she needed to check on something, and then she opened the door and stuck her head inside my room.
What the hell are you doing? She whispered,
but my mouth was too full to answer. I'll just be a moment, she called, and as she closed the door behind her and moved towards my bed, I began breaking the wax lips and candy necklaces pulled from pile number two. These were the second best things I had received, and while it hurt to destroy them, it would have hurt even more to give them away. I had just started to mutilate a miniature box of Red Hots when my mother pried them from my hands, accidentally finishing the job for me. BB-sized pellets clattered onto the floor, and as I followed them with my eyes, she snatched up a roll of Necco wafers.
Not those, I pleaded.
But rather than words, my mouth expelled chocolate. Chewed chocolate, which fell onto the sleeve of her sweater.
Not those, not those.
She shook her arm and the mound of chocolate dropped like a horrible turd upon my bedspread.
You should look at yourself, she said. I mean really look at yourself.
Along with the Necco wafers, she took several Tootsie Pops and a half dozen caramels wrapped in cellophane. I heard her apologize to the Tomkes for her absence, and then I heard my candy hitting the bottom of their bags. What do you say? Mrs. Tomke asked. And the children answered, thank you. While I was in trouble for not bringing my candy sooner, my sisters were in more trouble for not bringing theirs at all. We spent the early part of the evening in our rooms. Then one by one we eased our way back upstairs and joined our parents in front of the TV. I was the last to arrive and took a seat on the floor beside the sofa. The show was a Western, and even if my head had not been throbbing, I doubt I would have had the wherewithal to follow it. A posse of outlaws crested a rocky hilltop, squinting at a flurry of dust advancing from the horizon, and I thought again of the Tomkes, and of how alone and out of place they had looked in their dopey costumes. What was up with that kid's tail? I asked.
Shh,
my family said. For months I had protected and watched over these people. But now, with one stupid act, they had turned my pity into something hard and ugly. The shift wasn't gradual, but immediate, and it provoked an uncomfortable feeling of loss. We hadn't been friends, the Tomkes and I, but still I had given them the gift of my curiosity. Wondering about the Tomke family had made me feel generous, but now I would have to shift gears and find pleasure in hating them. The only alternative was to do as my mother had instructed and take a good look at myself. This was an old trick designed to turn one's hatred inward, and while I was determined not to fall for it, it was hard to shake the mental picture snapped by her suggestion. Here is a boy sitting on a bed, his mouth smeared with chocolate. He's a human being, but also he's a pig, surrounded by trash and gorging himself so that others may be denied. Were this the only image in the world, you'd be forced to give it your full attention. But fortunately, there were others. The stagecoach, for instance, coming round the bend with a cargo of gold. This shiny new Mustang convertible. This teenage girl, her hair a beautiful mane, sipping Pepsi through a straw.
one picture after another, on and on until the news, and whatever came on after the news. Let it snow. In Binghamton, New York, winter meant snow, and though I was young when we left, I was able to recall great heaps of it, and use that memory as evidence that North Carolina was, at best, a third-rate institution. What little snow there was would usually melt an hour or two after hitting the ground, and there you'd be in your windbreaker and unconvincing mittens, forming a lumpy figure made mostly of mud. Snow Negroes, we called them. The winter I was in the fifth grade, we got lucky. Snow fell, and for the first time in years, it accumulated. School was canceled, and 2 days later, we got lucky again. There were 8 inches on the ground, and rather than melting, it froze. On the fifth day of our vacation, my mother had a little breakdown. Our presence had disrupted the secret life she led while we were at school. And when she could no longer take it, she threw us out. It wasn't a gentle request, but something closer to an eviction. "Get the hell out of my house," she said. We reminded her that it was our house, too, and she opened the front door and shoved us into the carport. "And stay out," she shouted. My sisters and I went down the hill and sledded with other children from the neighborhood. A few hours later, we returned home, surprised to find that the door was still locked. "Oh, come on," we said. I rang the bell, and when no one answered, we went to the window and saw our mother in the kitchen, watching television. Normally, she waited until 5 o'clock to have a drink, but for the past few days, she'd been making an exception. Drinking didn't count if you followed a glass of wine with a cup of coffee, and so she had both a goblet and a mug positioned before her on the countertop. "Hey," we yelled, "open the door, it's us." We knocked on the pane, and without looking in our direction, she refilled her goblet and left the room. "That bitch," my sister Lisa said. We pounded again and again, and when our mother failed to answer, we went around back and threw snowballs at her bedroom window. "You are going to be in so much trouble when Dad gets home," we shouted. And in response, my mother pulled the drapes. Dusk approached. And as it grew colder, it occurred to us that we could possibly die. It happened, surely. Selfish mothers wanted the house to themselves, and their children were discovered years later, frozen like mastodons in blocks of ice. My sister Gretchen suggested that we call our father, but none of us knew his number, and he probably wouldn't have done anything anyway. He'd gone to work specifically to escape our mother. And between the weather and her mood, it could be hours or even days before he returned home. "One of us should get hit by a car," I said. "That would teach the both of them." I pictured Gretchen, her life hanging by a thread as my parents paced the halls of Rex Hospital, wishing they had been more attentive. It was really the perfect solution. With her out of the way, the rest of us would be more valuable and have a bit more room to spread out. "Gretchen, go lie in the street." "Make Amy do it," she said. Amy, in turn, pushed it off onto Tiffany, who was the youngest and had no concept of death. "It's like sleeping," we told her, "only you get a canopy bed." Poor Tiffany. She'd do just about anything in return for a little affection. All you had to do was call her Tiff, and whatever you wanted was yours. Her allowance money, her dinner, the contents of her Easter basket. Her eagerness to please was absolute and naked. When we asked her to lie in the middle of the street, her only question was, where? We chose a quiet dip between two hills, a spot where drivers were almost required to skid out of control. She took her place, this 6-year-old in a butter-colored coat, and we gathered on the curb to watch. The first car to happen by belonged to a neighbor, a fellow Yankee who had outfitted his tires with chains and stopped a few feet from our sister's body. "Is that a person?" he asked. "Well, sort of," Lisa said. She explained that we'd been locked out of our house, and though the man appeared to accept it as a reasonable explanation, I'm pretty sure it was him who told on us. Another car passed without incident, and then we saw our mother, this puffy figure awkwardly negotiating the crest of the hill. She did not own a pair of pants, and her legs were buried to the calf in snow. We wanted to send her home, to kick her out of nature just as she had kicked us out of the house, but it was hard to stay angry at someone that pitiful-looking. "Are you wearing your loafers?" Lisa asked. And in response, our mother raised her bare foot. "I was wearing loafers," she said. "I mean, really, it was there a second ago." This was how things went. One moment, she was locking us out of our own house, and the next, we were rooting around in the snow, looking for her left shoe. "Oh, forget about it," she said. "It'll turn up in a few days." Gretchen fitted her cap over my mother's foot. Lisa secured it with her scarf, and surrounding her tightly on all sides, we made our way back home. The Ship Shape. My mother and I were at the dry cleaners, standing behind a woman we had never seen. A nice-looking woman, my mother would later say. Well put together. Classy. The woman was dressed for the season in a light cotton shift patterned with oversized daisies. Her shoes matched the petals, and her purse, which was black and yellow striped, hung over her shoulder, buzzing the flowers like a lazy bumblebee. She handed in her claim check, accepted her garments, and then expressed gratitude for what she considered to be fast and efficient service. "You know," she said, "people talk about Raleigh, but it isn't really true, is it?" The Korean man nodded, the way you do when you're a foreigner and understand that someone has finished a sentence. He wasn't the owner, just a helper who'd stepped in from the back, and it was clear he had no idea what she was saying. "My sister and I are visiting from out of town," the woman said, a little louder now, and again the man nodded. "I'd love to stay a while longer and explore, but my home, well, one of my homes is on the garden tour, so I've got to get back to Williamsburg." I was 11 years old, yet still the statement seemed strange to me. If she'd hoped to impress the Korean, the woman had obviously wasted her breath. So who was this information for? "My home, well, one of my homes." By the end of the day, my mother and I had repeated this line no less than 50 times. The garden tour was unimportant, but the first part of her sentence brought us great pleasure. There was, as indicated by the dash, a pause between the words home and well. A brief moment in which she decided, oh, why not? The following word, one, had blown from her mouth as if propelled by a gentle breeze, and this was the difficult part. You had to get it just right, or else the sentence lost its power. Falling somewhere between a self-conscious laugh and a sigh of happy confusion, the one afforded her statement a double meaning. To her peers, it meant, look at me, I catch myself coming and going. And to the less fortunate, it was a way of saying, don't kid yourself, it's a lot of work having more than one house. The first dozen times we tried it, our voices sounded pinched and snobbish. But by mid-afternoon, they had softened. We wanted what this woman had. Mocking her made it seem hopelessly unobtainable, and so we reverted to our natural selves. My home, well, one of my homes. My mother said it in a rush, as if she were under pressure to be more specific. It was the same way she said, my daughter, well, one of my daughters. But a second home was more prestigious than a second daughter, and so it didn't really work. I went in the opposite direction, exaggerating the word one in a way that was guaranteed to alienate my listener. Say it like that and people are going to be jealous, my mother said. Well, isn't that what we want? Sort of, she said, but mainly we want them to be happy for us. But why should you be happy for someone who has more than you do? I guess it all depends upon the person, she said. Anyway, I suppose it doesn't matter. We'll get it right eventually. When the day arrives, I'm sure it'll just come to us. And so we waited. At some point in the mid to late 1960s, North Carolina began referring to itself as Variety Vacation Land.
The words were stamped onto license plates, and a series of television commercials reminded us that, unlike certain of our neighbors, we had both the beach and the mountains. There were those who bounced back and forth between one and the other, but most people tended to choose a landscape and stick to it. We ourselves were beach people, Emerald Isle people, but that was mainly my mother's doing. I don't think our father would have cared whether he took a vacation or not. Being away from home left him anxious and crabby, but our mother loved the ocean. She couldn't swim, but enjoyed standing at the water's edge with a pole in her hand. It wasn't exactly what you'd call fishing, as she caught nothing, and expressed neither hope nor disappointment in regard to her efforts. What she thought about while looking at the waves was a complete mystery, yet you could tell that these thoughts pleased her, and that she liked herself better while thinking them. One year our father waited too late to make our reservations, and we were forced to take something on the Sound. It wasn't a cottage, but a run-down house, the sort of place where poor people lived. The yard was enclosed by a chain-link fence, and the air was thick with the flies and mosquitoes normally blown away by ocean breezes. Midway through the vacation, a hideous woolly caterpillar fell from a tree and bit my sister Amy on the cheek. Her face swelled and discolored, and within an hour, were it not for her arms and legs, it would have been difficult to recognize her as a human. My mother drove her to the hospital, and when they returned, she employed my sister as Exhibit A, pointing as if this were not her daughter, but some ugly stranger forced to share our quarters. "This is what you get for waiting until the last minute," she said to our father. "No dunes, no waves, just this." From that year on, our mother handled the reservations. We went to Emerald Isle for a week every September, and were always oceanfront, a word that suggested a certain degree of entitlement. The oceanfront cottages were on stilts, which made them appear, if not large, then at least imposing. Some were painted, some were sided, Cape Cod style, with wooden shingles, and all of them had names, the cleverest being Loafer's Paradise. The owners had cut their sign in the shape of two moccasins resting side by side. The shoes were realistically painted, and the letters were bloated and listless, loitering like drunks against the soft faux leather. "Now that's a sign," our father would say, and we would agree. There was the Skinny Dipper, Pelican's Perch, Lazy Days, the Scotch Bonnet, Looney Dunes, the name of each house followed by the name and hometown of the owner. The Duncan clan, Charlotte. The Graftons, Rocky Mount. Hal and Jean Starling of Pinehurst. Signs that essentially said, my home, well, one of my homes. While at the beach, we sensed more than ever that our lives were governed by luck. When we had it, when it was sunny, my sisters and I felt as if we were somehow personally responsible. We were a fortunate family, and therefore everyone around us was allowed to swim and dig in the sand. When it rained, we were unlucky and stayed indoors to search our souls. "It'll clear after lunch," our mother would say, and we would eat carefully, using the placemats that had brought us luck in the past. When that failed, we would move on to Plan B. "Oh, Mother, you work too hard," we'd say. "Let us do the dishes. Let us sweep sand off the floor." We spoke like children in a fairy tale, hoping our goodness might lure the sun from its hiding place. "You and Father have been so kind to us. Here, let us massage your shoulders." If by late afternoon it still hadn't cleared, my sisters and I would drop the act and turn on one another, searching for the spoiler who had brought us this misfortune. Which of us seemed the least dissatisfied? Who had curled up on a mildewed bed with a book and a glass of chocolate milk, behaving as though the rain was not such a bad thing after all? We would find this person, most often my sister Gretchen, and then we would beat her. The summer I was 12, a tropical storm moved up the coast, leaving a sky the same mottled pewter as Gretchen's subsequent bruises. But the following year, we started with luck. My father found a golf course that suited him, and for the first time in memory, even he seemed to enjoy himself. Relaxing on the deck with a gin and tonic, surrounded by his toast-colored wife and children, he admitted that this really wasn't so bad. "I've been thinking to hell with these rental cottages," he said.
What do you say we skip the middleman and just buy a place? He spoke in the same tone he used when promising ice cream. Who's up for something sweet, he'd ask, and we'd pile into the car, passing the Tasty Freeze and driving to the grocery store where he'd buy a block of pus-colored ice milk, reduced for quick sale. Experience had taught us not to trust him, but we wanted a beach house so badly it was impossible not to get caught up in the excitement. Even our mother fell for it. Do you really mean this? She asked. Absolutely, he said. The next day, they made an appointment with a real estate agent in Morehead City. We'll just be discussing the possibility, my mother said. It's just a meeting, nothing more. We wanted to join them, but they took only Paul, who was 2 years old and unfit to be left in our company. The morning meeting led to a half dozen viewings, and when they returned, my mother's face was so impassive it seemed almost paralyzed. It was fine, she said. The real estate agent was very nice. We got the idea that she was under oath to keep something to herself, and that the effort was causing her actual physical pain. It's all right, my father said. You can tell him. Well, we saw this one place in particular, she told us. Now, it's nothing to get too worked up about, but it's perfect, my father said. A real beauty, just like your mother here. He came from behind and pinched her on the bottom. She laughed and swatted him with a towel, and we witnessed what we would later come to recognize as the rejuvenating power of real estate. It's what fortunate couples turn to when their sex life is faded and they're too pious for affairs. A second car might bring people together for a week or two, but a second home can revitalize a marriage for up to 9 months after the closing. Oh, Lou, my mother said, what am I going to do with you? Whatever you want, baby, he said. Whatever you want. It was queer when people repeated their sentences twice, but we were willing to overlook it in exchange for a beach house. My mother was too excited to cook that night, and so we ate dinner at the Sanitary Fish Market in Morehead City. On taking our seats, I expected my father to mention inadequate insulation or corroded pipes, the dark undersides of home ownership, but instead he discussed only the positive aspects. I don't see why we couldn't spend our Thanksgivings here. Hell, we could even come for Christmas, hang a few lights, get some ornaments. What do you think? A waitress passed the table, and without saying please, I demanded another Coke. She went to fetch it, and I settled back in my chair, drunk with the power of a second home. When school began, my classmates would court me, hoping I might invite them for the weekend, and I would make a game of pitting them against one another. This was what a person did when people liked him for all the wrong reasons, and I would grow to be very good at it. What do you think, David? My father asked. I hadn't heard the question, but said that it sounded good to me. I like it, I said. I like it. The following afternoon, our parents took us to see the house. Now, I don't want you to get your hopes up too high, my mother said, but it was too late for that. It was a 15-minute drive from one end of the island to the other, and along the way we proposed names for what we had come to think of as our cottage. I'd already given it a good deal of thought, but waited a few minutes before offering my suggestion. Are you ready? I said. Our sign will be the silhouette of a ship. Nobody said anything. Get it? I said. The shape of a ship. Our house will be called the Ship Shape. Well, you'd have to write that on the sign, my father said. Otherwise, nobody will get it. But if you write off the words, you'll ruin the joke. What about the Nut Hut? Amy said. Hey, my father said, now there's an idea. He laughed, not realizing, I guess, that there already was a Nut Hut. We'd passed it 1,000 times. How about something with the word sandpiper in it, my mother said. Everybody likes sandpipers, right? Normally, I would have hated them for not recognizing my suggestion as the best, but this was clearly a special time, and I didn't want to ruin it with brooding. Each of us wanted to be the one who came up with the name. An inspiration could be hiding anywhere. When the interior of the car had been exhausted of ideas, we looked out the window and searched the passing landscape. Two thin girls braced themselves before crossing the busy road, hopping from foot to foot on the scalding pavement. The Tar Heel, Lisa called out. No, the Wait and See, get it? S-E-A. A car trailing a motorboat pulled up to a gas pump. The Shell Station, Gretchen shouted. Everything we saw was offered as a possible name, and the resulting list of nominees confirmed that once you left the shoreline, Emerald Isle was sorely lacking in natural beauty. The TV antenna, my sister Tiffany said. The telephone pole. The toothless black man selling shrimp from the back of his van. The cement mixer. The overturned grocery cart. Gulls on a garbage can. My mother inspired the cigarette butt thrown out the window and suggested we look for ideas on the beach rather than on the highway. I mean, my God, how depressing can you get? She acted annoyed, but we could tell she was really enjoying it. Give me something that suits us, she said. Give me something that will last. What would ultimately last were those 15 minutes on the coastal highway, but we didn't know that then. When older, even the crankiest of us would accept them as proof that we were once a happy family. Our mother young and healthy. Our father the man who could snap his fingers and give us everything we wanted. The whole lot of us competing to name our good fortune. The house was, as our parents had promised, perfect. This was an older cottage with pine-paneled walls that gave each room the thoughtful quality of a den. Light fell in strips from the louvered shutters, and the furniture, which was included in the sale, reflected the taste of a distinguished sea captain. Once we'd claimed bedrooms and lain awake all night, mentally rearranging the furniture, it would be our father who'd say, "Now hold on a minute, it's not ours yet." By the next afternoon, he had decided that the golf course wasn't so great after all. Then it rained for 2 straight days, and he announced that it might be wiser to buy some land, wait a few years, and think about building a place of our own. I mean, let's be practical. Our mother put on her raincoat. She tied a plastic bag over her head and stood at the water's edge, and for the first time in our lives, we knew exactly what she was thinking. By our final day of vacation, our father decided that instead of building a place on Emerald Isle, we should improve the home we already had. Maybe add a pool, he said. What do you kids think about that? Nobody answered. By the time he'd finished wheedling it down, the house at the beach had become a bar in the basement. It looked just like a real bar with tall stools and nooks for wine. There was a sink for washing glasses, and an assortment of cartoon napkins illustrating the lighter side of alcoholism. For a week or two, my sisters and I tottered at the counter, pretending to be drunks, but then the novelty wore off, and we forgot all about it. On subsequent vacations, both with and without our parents, we would drive by the cottage we had once thought of as our own. Each of us referred to it by a different name, and over time, qualifiers became necessary. You know, our house. The summer after we didn't buy it, the new owners, or those people, as we like to call them, painted the shipshape yellow. In the late 70s, Amy noted that the Nut Hut had extended the carport and paved the driveway. Lisa was relieved when the Wait and See returned to its original color, and Tiffany was incensed when the toothless black man selling shrimp from the back of his van sported a sign endorsing Jesse Helms in the 1984 senatorial campaign. 5 years later, my mother called to report that the sandpiper had been badly damaged by Hurricane Hugo. It's still there, she said, but barely. Shortly thereafter, according to Gretchen, the Shell Station was torn down and sold as a vacant lot. I know that such a story does not quite work to inspire sympathy. My home, well, one of my homes fell through. We had no legitimate claim to self-pity. We're ineligible even to hold a grudge, but that didn't stop us from complaining. In the coming years, our father would continue to promise what he couldn't deliver, and in time we grew to think of him as an actor auditioning for the role of a benevolent millionaire. He'd never get the part, but liked the way that the words felt in his mouth. "What do you say to a new car?" he'd ask. "Who's up for a cruise to the Greek Isles?" He expected us to respond by playing the part of an enthusiastic family, but we were unwilling to resume our old roles. As if carried by a tide, our mother drifted further and further away, first to twin beds
and then down the hall to a room decorated with seascapes and baskets of sun-bleached sand dollars. It would have been nice, a place at the beach, but we already had a home with a bar. Besides, had things worked out, you wouldn't have been happy for us. We're not that kind of people. The Girl Next Door. Well, that little experiment is over, my mother said. You tried it, it didn't work out, so what do you say we just move on? She was dressed in her roll-up-the-shirt-sleeves outfit, the faded turquoise skirt, a cotton headscarf, and one of the sporty blouses my father had bought in the hope she might take up golf. We'll start with the kitchen, she said. That's always the best way, isn't it? I was moving again, this time because of the neighbors. Oh, no, my mother said. They're not to blame. Let's be honest now. She liked to take my problems back to the source, which was usually me. Like, for instance, when I got food poisoning, it wasn't the chef's fault. You're the one who wanted to go Oriental. You're the one who ordered the lo mein. Lo mein, it's two words. Oh, he speaks Chinese now. Tell me, Charlie Chan, what's a word for 6 straight hours of vomiting and diarrhea? What she meant was that I'd try to save money. The cheap Chinese restaurant, the $75 a month apartment. Cut corners and it'll always come back to bite you in the ass. That was one of her sayings. But if you didn't have money, how could you not cut corners? And whose fault is it that you don't have any money? I'm not the one who turned up his nose at a full-time job. I'm not the one who spends his entire paycheck down at the hobby shop. I understand that. Well, good, she said. And then we began to wrap the breakables. In my version of the story, the problem began with the child next door, a third grader who, according to my mother, was bad news right from the start. Put it together, she'd said when I first called to tell her about it. Take a step back. Think. But what was there to think about? She was a 9-year-old girl. Oh, they're the worst, my mother said. What's her name? Brandy? Well, that's cheap, isn't it? I'm sorry, I said, but aren't I talking to someone who named her daughter Tiffany? My hands were tied, she shouted. The damn Greeks had me up against a wall, and you know it. Whatever you say. So this girl, my mother continued, and I knew what she was going to ask before she even said it. What does her father do? I told her there wasn't a father, at least not one that I knew about. And then I waited as she lit a fresh cigarette. Let's see, she said. 9-year-old girl named after an alcoholic beverage. Single mother in a neighborhood the police won't even go to. What else have you got for me? She spoke as if I'd formed these people out of clay, as if it were my fault that the girl was 9 years old and her mother couldn't keep a husband. I don't suppose this woman has a job, does she? She's a bartender. Oh, that's splendid, my mother said. Go on. The woman worked nights and left her daughter alone from 4 in the afternoon until 2 or 3 in the morning. Both were blonde, their hair almost white, with invisible eyebrows and lashes. The mother darkened hers with pencil, but the girl appeared to have none at all. Her face was like the weather in one of those places with no discernible seasons. Every now and then the circles beneath her eyes would shade to purple. She might show up with a fat lip or a scratch on her neck, but her features betrayed nothing. You had to feel sorry for a girl like that. No father, no eyebrows, and that mother. Our apartments shared a common wall, and every night I'd hear the woman stomping home from work. Most often she was with someone, but whether alone or with company, she'd find some excuse to bully her daughter out of bed. Brandy had left a donut on the TV, or Brandy had forgotten to drain her bathwater. They're important lessons to learn, but there's something to be said for leading by example. I never went into their apartment, but what I saw from the door was pretty rough. Not simply messy or chaotic, but hopeless. The lair of a depressed person. Given her home life, it wasn't surprising that Brandy latched onto me. A normal mother might have wondered what was up. Her 9-year-old daughter spending time with a 26-year-old man. But this one didn't seem to care. I was just free stuff to her. A free babysitter, a free cigarette machine, the whole store. I'd hear her through the wall sometimes,
Hey, go ask your friend for a roll of toilet paper. Go ask your friend to make you a sandwich. If company was coming and she wanted to be alone, she'd kick the girl out. Why don't you go next door and see what your little playmate is up to? Before I moved in, Brandy's mother had used a couple downstairs, but you could tell that the relationship had soured. Next to the grocery carts chained to their porch was a store-bought sign, the no trespassing followed by a handwritten, "This means you, Brandy." There was a porch on the second floor as well, with one door leading to Brandy's bedroom and another door leading to mine. Technically, the two apartments were supposed to share it, but the entire thing was taken up with their junk, and so I rarely used it. "I can't wait until you get out of your little slumming phase," my mother said on first seeing the building. She spoke as if she'd been raised in splendor, but in fact, her childhood home had been much worse. The suits she wore, the delicate bridges holding her teeth in place, was all an invention. "You live in bad neighborhoods so you can feel superior," she'd say, the introduction always to a fight. "The point is to move up in the world. Even sideways will do in a pinch, but what's the point in moving down?" As a relative newcomer to the middle class, she worried that her children might slip back into the world of public assistance and bad teeth. The finer things were not yet in our blood, or at least that was the way she saw it. My thrift shop clothing drove her up the wall, as did the second-hand mattress lying without benefit of box springs upon my hardwood floor. "It's not ironic," she'd say. "It's not ethnic. It's filthy." Bedroom suites were fine for people like my parents, but as an artist, I preferred to rough it. Poverty lent my little dabblings a much-needed veneer of authenticity, and I imagined myself repaying the debt by gently lifting the lives of those around me. Not en masse, but one by one, the old-fashioned way. It was, I thought, the least I could do. I told my mother that I had allowed Brandy into my apartment, and she sighed deeply into her end of the telephone. "And I bet you gave her the grand tour, didn't you? Mr. Showoff. Mr. Big Shot." We had a huge fight over that one. I didn't call her for 2 days. Then the phone rang. "Brother," she said, "you have no idea what you are getting yourself into. A neglected girl comes to your door, and what are you supposed to do? Turn her away?" "Exactly," my mother said. "Throw her the hell out." But I couldn't. What my mother defined as boasting, I considered a standard show and tell. "This is my stereo system," I'd said to Brandy. "This is the electric skillet I received last Christmas, and here's a little something I picked up in Greece last summer." I thought I was exposing her to the things a regular person might own and appreciate, but all she heard was the possessive. "This is my honorable mention ribbon, meaning it belongs to me, it's not yours." Every now and then I'd give her a little something, convinced that she'd treasure it forever. A postcard of the Acropolis, pre-stamped envelopes, packaged towelettes bearing the insignia of Olympic Airways. "Really?" she'd say. "For me?" The only thing she owned, the only thing special, was a foot-tall doll in a clear plastic carrying case. It was a dime store version of one of those dolls from many countries, this one Spanish with a beet-red dress and a droopy mantilla on her head. Behind her, printed on cardboard, was the place where she lived, a piñata-lined street snaking up the hill to a dusty bullring. The doll had been given to her by her grandmother, who was 40 years old and lived in a trailer beside an army base. "What is this?" my mother asked. "A skit from Hee-Haw? Who the hell are these people?" "These people," I said, "are my neighbors, and I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't make fun of them. The grandmother doesn't need it, I don't need it, and I'm pretty sure a 9-year-old girl doesn't need it either." I didn't tell her that the grandmother was nicknamed Rascal, or that in the picture Brandy had shown me, the woman was wearing cut-off shorts and an ankle bracelet. "We don't talk to her anymore," Brandy said when I handed back the picture. "She's out of our life and we're glad of it." Her voice was dull and robotic, and I got the impression that the line had been fed to her by her mother. She used a similar tone when introducing her doll. "She's not for playing with, she's for display." Whoever imposed this rule had obviously backed it up with a threat. Brandy would trace her finger along the outside of the box, tempting herself, but never once did I see her lift the lid. It was as if the doll would explode if removed from her natural environment. Her world was the box, and a strange world it was. "See," Brandy said one day, "she's on her way home to cook up those clams." She was talking about the castanets dangling from the doll's wrist. It was a funny thought, childish, and I probably should have let it go rather than playing the know-it-all. "If she were an American doll, those might be clams," I said, "but instead she's from Spain, and those are called castanets." I wrote the word on a piece of paper. "Castanets, look it up." "She's not from Spain, she's from Fort Bragg." "Well, maybe she was bought there," I said, "but she's supposed to be Spanish." "What's that supposed to mean?" It was hard to tell without the eyebrows, but I think she was mad at me. "It's not supposed to mean anything," I said, "it's just true." "You're full of it. There's no such place." "Sure there is," I said. "It's right next to France." "Yeah, right. What's that, a store?" I couldn't believe I was having this conversation. How could you not know that Spain was a country? Even if he were 9 years old, it seems he would have picked it up on TV or something. "Oh, Brandy," I said, "we've got to find you a map." Because I couldn't do it any other way, we fell into a tight routine. I had a part-time construction job and would return home at exactly 5:30. 5 minutes later, Brandy would knock on my door and stand there blinking until I let her in. I was going through a little wood-carving phase at the time, whittling figures whose heads resembled the various tools I worked with during the day, a hammer, a hatchet, a wire brush. Before beginning, I'd arrange some paper and colored pencils on my desk. "Draw your doll," I'd say. "Copy the bullring in her little environment. Express yourself." I encouraged Brandy to broaden her horizons, but she usually quit after the first few minutes, claiming it was too much work. Mainly, she observed, her eyes shifting between my knife and the Spanish doll parked before her on the desktop. She'd talk about how stupid her teachers were, and then she'd ask what I'd do if I had $1 million. If I'd had $1 million at that time in my life, I probably would have spent every last penny of it on drugs, but I didn't admit it, because I wanted to set a good example. "Let's see," I'd say. "If I had that kind of money, I'd probably give it away." "Yeah, right. You'd what, just hand it out to people on the street?" "No, I'd set up a foundation and try to make a difference in people's lives." At this one, even the doll was gagging. When asked what she'd do with $1 million, Brandy described cars and gowns and heavy bracelets encrusted with gems. "But what about others?" I asked. "Don't you want to make them happy?" "No, I want to make them jealous." "You don't mean that," I'd say. "Try me." "Oh, Brandy." I'd make her a glass of chocolate milk, and she'd elaborate on her list until 6:55, when friendship period was officially over. If work had gone slowly and there weren't many shavings to sweep up, I might let her stay an extra 2 minutes, but never longer. "Why do I have to go right this second?" she asked one evening. "Are you going to work or something?" "Well, no, not exactly." "Then what's your hurry?" I never should have told her. The good part about being an obsessive compulsive is that you're always on time for work. The bad part is that you're on time for everything. Rinsing your coffee cup, taking a bath, walking your clothes to the laundromat. There's no mystery to your comings and goings, no room for spontaneity. During that time of my life, I went to the IHOP every evening, heading over on my bike at exactly 7 and returning at exactly 9. I never ate there, just drank coffee, facing the exact same direction and the exact same booth, and reading library books for exactly an hour. After this, I would ride to the grocery store. Even if I didn't need anything, I'd go because that's what that time was allotted for. If the lines were short, I'd bike home the long way or circle the block a few times, unable to return early as those 5 or 10 minutes weren't scheduled for apartment time. "What would happen if you were 10 minutes late?" Brandy asked. My mother often asked the same question. Everyone did. "You think the world will fall apart if you walk through the door at 9:04? They said it jokingly, but the answer was, yes, that's exactly what I thought would happen. The world would fall apart. On the nights when another customer occupied my regular IHOP booth, I was shattered. "Is there a problem?" the waitress would ask. And I'd find that I couldn't even speak. Brandy had been incorporated into my schedule for a little over a month when I started noticing that certain things were missing. Things like pencil erasers and these little receipt books I'd picked up in Greece. And searching through my drawers and cabinets, I discovered that other things were missing as well. A box of tacks, a key ring in the form of a peanut. "I see where this is going," my mother said. "The little sneak unlatched your porch door and wandered over while you were off at the pancake house. That's what happened, isn't it?" I hated that she'd figured it out so quickly. When I confronted Brandy, she broke down immediately. It was as if she'd been dying to confess, had rehearsed it even. The stammered apology, the plea for mercy. She hugged me around the waist, and when she finally pulled away, I felt my shirt front, expecting to find it wet with tears. It wasn't. I don't know why I did what I did next, or rather, I guess I do. It was all part of my ridiculous plan to set a good example. "You know what we have to do now, don't you?" I sounded firm and fair until I considered the consequences, at which point I faltered. "We've got to go and tell your mother what you just did." I half hoped that Brandy might talk me out of it, but instead she just shrugged. "I bet she did," my mother said. "I mean, come on, you might as well have reported her to the cat. What did you expect that mother to do, needlepoint a sampler with the Ten Commandments? Wake up, dopey, the woman's a whore." Of course she was right. Brandy's mother listened with her arms crossed, a good sign until I realized that her anger was directed toward me rather than her daughter. In the far corner of the room, a long-haired man cleaned beneath his fingernails with a pair of scissors. He looked my way for a moment and then turned his attention back to the television. "So she took a pencil eraser," Brandy's mother said. "What do you want me to do, dial 911? She made it sound unbelievably petty. "I just thought you should know what happened," I said. "Well, lucky me, now I know." I returned to my apartment and pressed my ear against the bedroom wall. "Who was that?" the guy asked. "Just some asshole," Brandy's mother said. Things cooled down after that. I could forgive Brandy for breaking into my apartment, but I could not forgive her mother. Just some asshole. I wanted to go to the place where she worked and burn it down. In relating the story, I found myself employing lines I'd probably heard on public radio. "Children want boundaries," I said. "They need them." It sounded sketchy to me, but everyone seemed to agree, especially my mother, who suggested that in this particular case, a 5x11 cell might work. She wasn't yet placing the entire blame on me, so it was still enjoyable to tell her things, to warm myself against the comforting glow of her outrage. The next time Brandy knocked, I pretended to be out, a ploy that fooled no one. She called my name, figured out where this was headed, and then went home to watch TV. I didn't plan to stay mad forever. A few weeks of the silent treatment, and then I figured we'd pick up where we left off. In the meantime, I occasionally passed her in the front yard, just standing there as if she were waiting for someone normal to pick her up. I'd say, "Hello, how's it going?" And she'd give me this tight little smile, the sort you'd offer if someone you hated was walking around with chocolate stains on the back of his pants. Back when our neighborhood was prosperous, the building we lived in was a single-family home, and sometimes I like to imagine it as it once was, with proud rooms and chandeliers, a stately working household serviced by maids and coachmen. I was carrying out the trash one afternoon and came upon what used to be the coal cellar, a grim crawl space now littered with shingles and mildewed cardboard boxes. There were worn-out fuses and balls of electrical wire, and there, in the back, a pile of objects I recognized as my own. Things I hadn't noticed were missing, photographs, for instance, and slides of my bad artwork. Moisture had fouled the casings, and when I backed out of the cellar and held them to the sun, I saw that the film had been scratched, not by accident, but intentionally, with a pin or a razor. "You're a asshole," one of them read. "Suck my dick, why don't you?" The spelling was all over the place, the writing tiny and furious, bleeding into the mind-bending designs spewed by mental patients who don't know when to stop.
It was the exact effect I'd been striving for in my bland imitation folk art. So not only did I feel violated, I felt jealous. I mean, this girl was the real thing. There were pages of slides, all of them etched with ugly messages. Photographs, too, were ruined. Here was me as a toddler with the word shitty scratched into my forehead. Here was my newlywed mother netting crabs with her eyes clawed out. Included in the pile were all the little presents accepted with such false gratitude, the envelopes and postcards, even the towelettes, everything systematically destroyed. I gathered it all up and went straight to Brandy's mother. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and she was dressed in one of those thigh-length robes people wear when practicing karate. This was morning for her, and she stood drinking cola from a tall glass mug. "Fuck," she said. "Haven't we been through this?" "Well, actually, no." My voice was higher than normal and unstable. "Actually, we haven't been through this." I'd considered myself an outsider in this neighborhood, something like a missionary among the savages, but standing there panting, my hair netted with cobwebs, I got the horrible feeling that I fit right in. Brandy's mother glanced down at the filthy stack in my hand, frowning as if these were things I was trying to sell door to door. "You know what," she said, "I don't need this right now. No, you know what? I don't need it, period. Do you think having a baby was easy for me? I don't have nobody helping me out, a husband or daycare or whatever. I'm all alone here, understand?" I tried putting the conversation back on track, but as far as Brandy's mother was concerned, there was no other track. It was all about her. "I work my own hours and cover shifts for Kathy fucking Cornelius, and on my one day off, I've got some faggot hassling me about some shit I don't even know about? I don't think so. Not today I don't, so why don't you just go find somebody else to dump on?" She slammed the door in my face, and I stood in the hallway wondering, who is Kathy Cornelius? What just happened? In the coming days, I ran the conversation over and over in my mind, thinking of all the fierce and sensible things I should have said. Things like, "Hey, I'm not the one who decided to have children," and "It's not my problem that you have to cover shifts for Kathy fucking Cornelius." "It wouldn't have made any difference," my mother said. "A woman like that, the way she sees it, she's a victim. Everyone's against her, no matter what." I was so angry and shaken that I left the apartment and went to stay with my parents on the other side of town. My mom drove me to the IHOP and back right on schedule, but it wasn't the same. On my bike, I was left to my own thoughts, but now I had her lecturing me, both coming and going. "What did you hope to gain by letting that girl into your apartment? And don't tell me you wanted to make a difference in her life, please. I just ate." I got it that night and then again the following morning. "Do you want me to give you a ride back to your little shanty town?" she asked. But I was mad at her, and so I took the bus. I thought things couldn't get much worse, and then that evening, they did. I was just returning from the IHOP and was on the landing outside of Brandy's door when I heard her whisper, "Faggot." She had her mouth to the keyhole, and her voice was puny and melodic. It was the way I'd always imagined a moth might sound. "Faggot, what's the matter, faggot? What's wrong, huh?" She laughed as I scrambled into my apartment, and then she ran to the porch and began to broadcast through my bedroom door. "Little faggot, little tattletale. You think you're so smart, but you don't know shit." "That's it," my mother said. "We've got to get you out of there." There was no talk of going to the police or social services. Just pack up your things. She won. "But can I?" "Oh, no," my mother said. "You've got her mad now, and there's no turning back. All she has to do is go to the authorities saying you molested her. Is that what you want? One little phone call and your life is ruined." "But I didn't do anything. I'm gay, remember?" "That's not going to save you," she said. "Push comes to shove, and who do you think they're going to believe? A 9-year-old girl or a full-grown man who gets his jollies carving little creatures out of balsa wood?" "They're not little creatures," I yelled. "They're tool people. What the hell difference does it make? In the eyes of the law, you're just some nut with a knife who sits in the pancake house staring at a goddamn stopwatch. You dress that girl in something other than a tube top and prop her up on the witness stand, crying her eyes out, and what do you think is going to happen? Get that mother in on the act, and you've got both a criminal trial and a civil suit on your hands." "You watch too much TV," I said.
Not as much as they do, she said. I can guarantee you that. You think these people can't smell money? But I haven't got any. It's not your money they'll be after, she said. It's mine. You mean Dad's. I was smarting over the little creature's comment and wanted to hurt her, but it didn't work. I mean our money, she said. You think I don't know how these things work? I wasn't just born some middle-aged woman with a nice purse and a decent pair of shoes. My God, the things you don't know. My God. My new apartment was 8 blocks away, facing our city's first Episcopal church. My mother paid the deposit and the first month's rent and came with her station wagon to help me pack and move my things. Carrying a box of my featherweight balsa wood sculptures out onto the landing, her hair gathered beneath a gingham scarf, I wondered how she appeared to Brandy, who was certainly watching through the keyhole. What did she represent to her? The word mother wouldn't do, as I really don't think she understood what it meant. A person who shepherds you along the way and helps you out when you're in trouble. What would she call that thing? A queen? A crutch? A teacher? I heard a noise from behind the door, and then the little moth voice. Bitch, Brandy whispered. I fled back into the apartment, but my mother didn't even pause. Sister, she said, you don't know the half of it. Repeat after me. Although we discussed my upcoming visit to Winston-Salem, my sister and I didn't make exact arrangements until the eve of my arrival, when I phoned from a hotel in Salt Lake City. I'll be at work when you arrive, she said, so I'm thinking I'll just leave the key under the our-ot near the ek door. The what? Our-ot. I thought she had something in her mouth until I realized she was speaking in code. What, do you want a speakerphone at a methadone clinic? Why can't you just tell me where you put the goddamn house key? Her voice dropped to a whisper. I just don't know that I trust these things. Are you on a cell phone? Of course not, she said. This is just a regular cordless, but still you have to be careful. When I suggested that actually she didn't have to be careful, Lisa resumed her normal tone of voice, saying, really? But I heard... My sister's a type who religiously watches the fear segments of her local eyewitness news broadcasts, retaining nothing but the headline. She remembers that applesauce can kill you, but forgets that in order to die you have to inject it directly into your bloodstream. Pronouncements that cell phone conversations may be picked up by strangers, mixed with the reported rise of both home burglaries and brain tumors, meaning that as far as she's concerned, all telecommunication is potentially life-threatening. If she didn't watch it on the news, she read it in Consumer Reports or heard it third-hand from a friend of a friend of a friend whose ear caught fire while dialing her answering machine. Everything is dangerous all of the time, and if it's not yet been pulled off the shelves, then it's certainly under investigation, so there. Okay, I said. But can you tell me which hour, Aunt? Last time I was there, you had quite a few of them. It's Ed, she told me. Well, Ed-ish. I arrived at Lisa's house late the following afternoon, found the key beneath the flower pot, and let myself in through the back door. A lengthy note on the coffee table explained how I might go about operating everything from the television to the waffle iron, each carefully detailed procedure ending with the line, "Remember to turn off and unplug after use." At the bottom of page 3, a postscript informed me that if the appliance in question had no plug, the dishwasher, for instance, I should make sure it had completed its cycle and was cool to the touch before leaving the room. The note reflected a growing hysteria, its subtext shrieking, "Oh my God, he's going to be alone in my house for close to an hour." She left her work number, her husband's work number, and the number of the next-door neighbor, adding that she didn't know the woman very well, so I probably shouldn't bother her unless it was an emergency, P.P.S. She's a Baptist, so don't tell her you're gay. The last time I was alone at my sister's place, she was living in a white brick apartment complex occupied by widows and single, middle-aged working women. This was in the late 70s when we were supposed to be living in dorms. College hadn't quite worked out the way she'd expected, and after 2 years in Virginia, she returned to Raleigh and taken a job at a wine store. It was a normal enough life for a 21-year-old, but being a dropout was not what she had planned for herself. Worse than that, it had not been planned for her. As children, we'd been assigned certain roles: leader, bum, troublemaker, slut. Titles that effectively told us who we were. As the oldest, smartest, and bossiest, it was naturally assumed that Lisa would shoot to the top of her field, earning a master's degree in manipulation and eventually taking over a medium-sized country. We'd always known her as an authority figure, and while we took a certain joy in watching her fall, it was disorienting to see her with so little confidence. Suddenly, she was relying on other people's opinions, following their advice and withering at the slightest criticism. "Do you really think so? Really?" She was putty. My sister needed patience and understanding, but more often than not, I found myself wanting to shake her. If the oldest wasn't who she was supposed to be, then what did it mean for the rest of us? Lisa had been marked most likely to succeed, and so it confused her to be ringing up gallon jugs of hearty burgundy. I had been branded as lazy and irresponsible, so it felt right when I, too, dropped out of college and wound up living back in Raleigh. After being thrown out of my parents' house, I went to live with Lisa in her white brick complex. It was a small studio apartment, the adult version of her childhood bedroom, and when I eventually left her with a broken stereo and an unpaid $80 phone bill, the general consensus was, well, what did you expect? I might reinvent myself to strangers, but to this day, as far as my family is concerned, I'm still the one most likely to set your house on fire. While I accepted my lowered expectations, Lisa fought hard to regain her former title. The wine shop was just a temporary setback, and she left shortly after becoming the manager. Photography interested her, and so she taught herself to use a camera, ultimately landing a job in the photo department of a large international drug company, where she took pictures of germs, viruses, and people reacting to germs and viruses. On weekends, for extra money, she photographed weddings, which really wasn't that much of a stretch. Then she got married herself and quit the drug company in order to earn an English degree. When told there was very little call for 30-page essays on Jane Austen, she got a real estate license. When told the housing market was down, she returned to school to study plants. Her husband Bob got a job in Winston-Salem, and so they moved, buying a new three-story house in a quiet suburban neighborhood. It was strange to think of my sister living in such a grown-up place, and I was relieved to find that neither she nor Bob particularly cared for it. The town was nice enough, but the house itself had a way of aging things. Stand outside and you looked, if not young, then at least relatively carefree. Step indoors and you automatically put on 20 years and a 401k plan. My sister's home didn't really lend itself to snooping, and so I spent my hour in the kitchen making small talk with Henry. It was the same conversation we'd had the last time I saw him, yet still I found it fascinating. He asked how I was doing. I said I was all right. And then, as if something might have drastically changed within the last few seconds, he asked again. Of all the elements of my sister's adult life, the house, the husband, the sudden interest in plants, the most unsettling is Henry. Technically, he's a blue-fronted Amazon, but to the average layman, he's just a big parrot, the type you might see on the shoulder of a pirate. "How are you doing?" The third time he asked, it sounded as if he really cared. I approached his cage with a detailed answer, and when he lunged for the bars, I screamed like a girl and ran out of the room. "Henry likes you," my sister said a short while later. She'd just returned from her job at the plant nursery and was sitting at the table, unlacing her sneakers. "See the way he's fanning his tail? You'd never do that for Bob, would you, Henry? Bob had returned from work a few minutes earlier and immediately headed upstairs to spend time with his own bird, a balding, green-cheeked conure named Jose. I thought the two pets might enjoy an occasional conversation, but it turns out they can't stand each other. "Don't even mention Jose in front of Henry," Lisa whispered. Bob's bird squawked from the upstairs study, and the parrot responded with a series of high, piercing barks. It was a trick he'd picked up from Lisa's border collie, Chessie, and what was disturbing was that he sounded exactly like a dog, just as when speaking English he sounded exactly like Lisa. It was creepy to hear my sister's voice coming from a beak, but I couldn't say it didn't please me. "Who's hungry?" she asked. "Who's hungry?" the voice repeated. I raised my hand and she offered Henry a peanut. Watching him take it in his claw, his belly sagging almost to the perch, I could understand what someone might see in a parrot. Here was this strange little fatso living in my sister's kitchen.